sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined on the show today by attorney, author, and former U.S. State Department diplomat J. Michael Springman. As a diplomat, he spent 5 years in Germany, 2 in India, and nearly 2 in Saudi Arabia. On today's show, we're going to be discussing his new book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. In this new book, he argues that forced migration is a subtle form of warfare waged by U.S. foreign policy with a double intent, to destabilize Middle Eastern nations and to weaken Europe. Immigration has become a very controversial topic, so please understand, as you listen to this program, that we are not against immigrants. And the purpose of this show is to expose the exploitation of immigrants by using them as a weapon to destabilize, in this case, the Middle East, and to weaken Europe. So here's the interview with author Michael Springman. Michael Springman, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
And I know you've been on the show several times before, and one time was to discuss your previous book called Visas for Al-Qaeda. And you were also one of our panelists on the banned Deep State panels at the Left Forum earlier in June this year, discussing terrorism there, and that's where you gave me a copy of your great new book called Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. And that's what we're going to talk about today, your new book. So maybe, Mike, you could start by giving us a brief overview of your first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, because I think that kind of sets the stage for your second book.
It does indeed. Basically, the first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, talks about how the United States created and used the international Islamic terrorism. Initially, I was in at the beginning when they were recruiting people for the Mujahideen to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan back in the 1980s. I was in Jeddah and being told repeatedly to issue visas to people who simply weren't qualified to have them. And it was never explained to me why. And it wasn't until I was out of the Foreign Service, having been fired without any real reason, that I learned from a contact with a journalist, Joe Trento, that they were recruiting the Mujahideen. They were sending them through Jeddah to get visas to go to the United States for training. Generally, as I learned later on in researching the book, at military facilities, generally in the eastern United States and most often in North Carolina. Over the years, I had sort of written and spoken out about what went on there, but didn't have the full story until I finally gave up with the Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. The first had been sealed as a threat to national security, and the second one was simply dismissed because the judge claimed that I had not exhausted all my administrative remedies, which in fact I had. But he was on the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, appointed by the Bush administration, and he was going to do what he was going to do. So I started writing and doing research and learned that the people that had been recruited for the Mujahideen were then sent to Yugoslavia to work with NATO in the United States to essentially dismember the country and turn it into powerless statelets that were far worse off than they were before. The same crowd, you know, was Osama bin Laden's boys there, and Osama himself was in Yugoslavia. They then moved into Iraq and helped wreck that country there as well. And then the same crowd, and maybe not the same guys, but people they trained or people that had been recruited after them, went to Libya, and with the assistance of the United States and the European countries such as Britain, France, and Italy, and their intelligence services, ruined Libya, which had the highest quality of life of any country in Africa, thanks to Muammar Gaddafi, the director, and his skillful use of oil to provide health care and education and things like this. But then, while Libya was being wrecked, the same people then began moving weapons and themselves into Syria to help destroy Bashar al-Assad, because this was American policy. Bashar was a secular leader, as was Muammar Gaddafi, and so was Saddam Hussein. I mean, they were all not perhaps philosopher kings, but these people had their country going, they had their country operating, people were being educated. Iraq, for example, had the highest level of education of any country in the Middle East. The language of instruction for medicine there was English. So following the Israeli Ginon plan, which was created by a journalist attached to their foreign ministry, was basically to get the Arabs and Muslims fighting each other, and that way this guarantees Israel's security. And this is exactly what's happened. All the countries in the region have been fighting, either internally or with external forces such as NATO, and the countries have been destroyed. And Syria still exists, and there is a government there, but the problem is it's never going to recover. It's pretty much destroyed, pretty much like Iraq and Yugoslavia and Libya. So there really isn't much left once the fighting stops. So this was basically the situation when I started thinking about my new book, being prompted by Sylvia Germack, who had come from Yugoslavia, who had lived in Germany and is now in the United States. And she said, look, you really got to write about this. And I delayed doing it because I was promoting the first book and making sure the word got out and people bought the book. And my whole intent in writing the book was not to make a pocket of money, but to tell the story of what really happened and why. And I've done the same thing with the follow-on book, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos. In this book, I take what's happened, the destroyed countries and the waves of migrants that are coming out of these countries, and they're not being helped in camps in their own countries or near their own countries. They're being herded into Europe through Turkey, which was a holding tank for these people. And then all of a sudden they were released in their millions to cross into Greece, to cross into Italy, and either move up through Italy into Europe or the rest of Europe, or through the Balkans from Greece, again into Europe, into the high-benefit-rich countries like Germany and then the Scandinavian states. So I go and talk about this, talk about all of the peculiar people involved in this. For example, they're being guided by the intelligence services, obviously. They've arranged for passports to be given to them. Qatar was producing them at one point. The French were making Syrian passports for the Syrian government prior to 2011. And who's to say they haven't stopped? Going into the hands of bad boys, and they're concealed in this mass of refugees, some of whom are obviously really and truly identifiable as refugees and asylum seekers. But you've got a lot of economic asylum seekers. You've got a lot of criminals in there, and you've got a lot of terrorists that have been slipped into it as well.
And Mike, maybe you can tell us about who Kelly Greenhill is and what mm-hmm. she's done and how she plays into this.
Sure. Kelly Greenhill drew up the template for this. She wrote the instruction manual. About 2010, she published a book called Weapons of Mass Migration. And the main thrust of the book was the fact that the way you destabilize countries or groups, if you want to talk about that, is to take the group of the country and force these people out of it. You remove them, you push them out. In the case of countries, for example, you take away the workers and the doctors, the lawyers, and the Indian chiefs, and you send them into another group or another country that has to absorb them, and they have costs. You've got the cost of a country losing its population, like Iraq losing its middle class, and then you've got, for example, Germany trying to absorb a million people with no known language in common with the people in Germany, with a lower educational standard in a high-technology country.
So Kelly Greenhill has kind of laid out the plan. In your book, you talk about her connections to perhaps the CIA. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Sure. She has a long history of being tied into the national security establishment. She has degrees from Harvard, for example, and other universities in the Northeast. She's worked at a number of think tanks connected with these universities and with the Pentagon. For example, she'd been with the DARPA, the defense. Can't think of what the acronym stands for now.
DARPA stands for Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And according to their website, for more than 50 years, DARPA has held to a singular and enduring mission to make pivotal investments in breakthrough technologies for national security. They're part of the Defense Department. But many think they're a frightening organization with little oversight and that some of the work they do is very questionable. For example, they work on mind control and ways to program the human brain and ways to make it easier for the government to use propaganda, just to name a few of their frightening projects.
But she worked with them. She had worked in Senator John Kerry's office at one point, and she has teaching positions in a number of these universities, so she's free to spread the word on how to do it and why to do it. And she makes a point of costs in all of this. She says that liberal democracies are patsies because along the way they have signed agreements and treaties and such like to do their very best to take in asylum seekers, to prevent people from being cast back into the outer darkness, for example. But at the same time, she mentions in the foreword to her book, one refugee is a novelty, 10 refugees are boring, and 100 refugees are a menace. You have these costs. You can't absorb a million people, yet at the same time, if you want to send a million people back, people are saying, why? These people just want a better life. They want to pay taxes. They want to live in houses and have real jobs and so on and so forth, much like the propaganda here in the States for all of the illegal aliens coming across the border. And I think this was taken and refined and aimed at the Europeans to get them to absorb this wave of people. The wave of people, of course, weakens the countries they're leaving, all the people from Libya, all the people from Syria, and so on. And it weakens the European countries that have to absorb them. In Munich, for example, there were 50,000 people, one city councilman said, being penned up in a stadium, a sports stadium, and they had no place to put them. But they had to sleep on the ground because, you know, nowhere in the world in Germany is 50,000 air mattresses to put between these people in the cold, hard ground.
So, Mike, tell me, who's behind this? Who's funding this? Because obviously it's pretty expensive to leave a country and travel through these other countries to get to Germany or Sweden or wherever they're going. Who's behind it? And then why are they doing this?
Well, the people behind it are principally the American government, because they're very much concerned with a strong and resurgent Germany allying itself with Russia, or the rest of Europe with Germany allying itself to Russia, because you have Russian vast resources coupled with German and European technology, education, and know-how, and they will make a formidable opponent and a competitor for the United States. And how they're doing it is supplying false passports, supplying cell phones, supplying Wi-Fi services in the Balkans and along the other migrant routes. And they're buying boats for these people. The Turkish Navy, for example, is convoying boatloads of migrants to the Greek Isles so they can swarm their way up the Balkans. And you've got organizations and people. You've got think tanks like Gerald Canales' think tank in Austria. And you've got Diederik Samson, the Dutch politician. And then you've got Peter Sutherland, the former Attorney General of Ireland, and the guy who is a special representative for the UN Office of Migration. They've all worked together to come up with the idea that Europe needs to be more multicultural. It's too monolithic. You need new blood into the various countries in Europe, especially those with such a low birth rate that they're not reproducing and replacing themselves. And they're concerned that there won't be enough money in the kitty anymore to pay the generous social benefits that the European countries have voted for their population. But unfortunately, this is a false dream, and it's being sold to some of these European governments because these people, yes, they will come in, they will initially take jobs, but basically they don't have the education, they don't have the training, and they don't have the skills to be productive. They're going to slide downhill to grass cutters and street sweepers and garbage men. And along the way, they're going to be supported by the European taxpayers. One German economist has calculated that it would cost close to $1 trillion for Germany's benefit system to support these people that they've all brought in. It's at least a million. They're never really sure of the total number.
So do you think, Mike, that Angela Merkel knows that this is a forced migration, that it's a weapon, or does she really believe that she's just helping these people out?
I don't think she really believes she's helping these people out. Angela Merkel is not stupid. She has a PhD in physics, but she has a very nasty background that she's very carefully kept hidden. For example, she was born in what was then West Germany in Hamburg and moved with her parents as an infant to Templin in East Germany, the communist state, and she lived there for 35 years until the change and the two countries were reunified. And at one point, she had been involved with agitation and propaganda with the East German Youth Party. She had supposedly denied being recruited by their state security service, the Stasi. But in fact, she had said at one point, well, if we have to reform East Germany, we're not going to do it in the way the West Germans have reformed themselves. So I think she has a lot of this East German mentality, this top-down ordering people around, and you will do as I say, not as what you want to do. She's also put a number of old Stasi people in high positions. There's one woman in charge, for example, of hate crimes in Germany, which have been popped up because people are objecting to this wave of migrants, and anybody who speaks against this is automatically guilty of hate crimes. Well, the old Stasi woman, whose code name was Victoria, is now in charge of this, and he was hand-selected by Merkel's justice minister, Heiko Maas.
So why would she go along with this weaponized migration that could destabilize Germany? Why would she do that?
Well, she thinks that she's going to come out ahead no matter what. She thinks that in the case of Germany, the short-term benefits of being seen as a great European leader, as someone who saved the European Union and has fought off all of the right-wing organizations that are saying put a limit to migration, she thinks she can manage that. And being a typical politician, she doesn't care all that much for the people as long as she keeps getting reelected. And in addition, I think Merkel has this idea that she's been sold on the borderless society, a Europe of Europeans, not a Europe of Germans, Italians, French, Scandinavians, or whatever. So I think she figures this will help, and this will help bring down the barriers. And with the barriers down, you have much more maneuvering room, and you can do more things with fewer objections.
There was an incident in December of, I think it was 2015, where a bunch of the immigrants, they're mostly men, I guess, gathered around, and one was in Cologne, Germany, and in other locations in Europe, and where they sexually assaulted women. And what I'm wondering is, this happened at the same time in many different cities in Europe. How could that possibly be just all coincidental? It looks like it was organized. Can you
speak to that? It was organized just like these terrorist attacks in Syria, for example, are organized. You've got people with their cell phones. You've got them wired up and connected thanks to George Soros and Cisco Systems, for example, who've set up and paid for these things. And cell phones in Syria, for example, are not any real cheaper than they are here in the United States. Conceivably, you can get used phones or refurbished phones or whatever. But still, in all, they cost money, and you have to keep them charged. And yet these people, December 31st, 2015, you're exactly right, they had 1,000 of them in Cologne in the railroad station square and in front of the cathedral there, grabbing women, raping them, robbing them, groping them. This went all over the country, in Stuttgart, for example, in the south, and smaller towns in the southwest. They had the same thing, and, of course, the police did almost nothing. In fact, the Lord Mayor of Cologne, Henrietta Raker, who used to be a member of Merkel's old party, the Christian Democratic Union, she said, well, you know, in a crowd like this, women should keep it on arm's length away from strange men. Well, how do you do this in a crowd of thousands is beyond me. But in one instance, the Alternative for Germany Youth Party, far the right-wing party that's very much opposed to the migration issue, put up a poster of this beautiful woman in an evening gown holding a huge revolver at arm's length with the caption that said, yes, Raker is right. An arm's length is real security.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So it's very carefully coordinated. I mean, it wasn't something that just happened. It happened all in one night. And the police and the news services played it down, saying in one instance in South Germany, oh, well, the girls just went with these migrant boys into their house and there was an exchange of tendernesses, like they had invited the rape themselves. It was their fault.
So who's benefiting from all of this?
The people who are benefiting are essentially people like George Soros, who can make money on confusion and economic upheaval. The security services are benefiting. They're getting more money, and they're getting more powers, and greater powers than in the past. And sometimes you wonder if the security services aren't involved in this in some way either. Is it some kind of dark Trojan horse? Because you've got one instance where there was a guy, in fact, several guys, whose backgrounds have been known to be criminal, yet somehow got asylum or were denied asylum in Germany but not sent home because they couldn't figure out where home was since these people had trashed their papers. In one instance, the Internal German Security Service, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, had hired a guy, given him security checks, and it turned out that the guy was Spanish. He was a convert to Islam, supposedly, and he was a homosexual actor in gay porn videos. And the politicians wanted to know how this had happened because he was found out only because another member of the Internal Security Organization was trolling the Internet trying to find potential terrorists and came across this guy. So you really wonder what's going on inside the German government.
Yeah, because I know even Merkel, they had, I guess, quotas or they had limits to who they would take in, and then she dropped it all in, I don't think it was again 2015, I could have that wrong. But
yeah, August 25th.
Okay, and just let anybody come across the border, is that correct?
Mm. Yeah, they came across by the thousands. There were 10,000 people from Hungary swarmed across the border in one day.
And why would she do that? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, she wanted to appear that welcoming to people and show that she was, as Hillary Clinton had said, the most admired woman in Europe. And she wanted to show that Germany was doing something because Germany had power and Germany would dictate, just as they had dictated to the Greeks in their economic collapse and making the austerity there even harder. And then I think she really didn't perhaps have a grasp of how many would actually come across. And she lost track of all thousands upon thousands of them. And there's still 10,000 children that are unaccounted for.
Yeah, that's another thing. Tell us about the makeup of the immigrants.
Well, they're mostly men. And it doesn't matter whether it's in Germany or whether it's in Sweden or any other country. It's, by and large, mostly young, single men under 35. There are some women. And as far as unaccompanied children go, there again, you've got the bulge of the males far outnumbering the females if they're unaccompanied.
So it's interesting, if you're in Syria and you lose a lot of your young men under 35, then you may lose a lot of your potential soldiers and people that will move the society forward once the war is over.
Exactly. That's part of this Green Hill coercion clause. You force these people out, you destroy the country by losing their best and their brightest, and then you dump these people into another country that can't handle them, they don't speak the language. I mean, there's no pool of Dari or Pashtun or Arabic speakers in Europe. And the same goes for the people leaving themselves. I mean, how many Dari speakers from Afghanistan are able to deal with German or Italian or French?
So, Mike, what's happening now in Europe? Has the migration flow stopped or is it continuing?
No, it's continuing. Just in the last week or so, there has been a new wave of migrants crossing from Libya into Italy. Italy used to be the main target because it's not that far from Africa. And then it had moved to Greece because you could go from Turkey to Greece with no trouble at all. I mean, the islands are like stepping stones almost. But now the wave is crossing again from Libya, all the people from sub-Saharan Africa in boats. I saw a video by the German external news agency, Deutsche Welle, DW, and they were very unhappy that this Libyan Coast Guard boat was trying to get between a German migrant-collecting ship, the Sea-Watch, and this boatload of 500 migrants that are crammed into this thing almost from edge to edge. You could hardly breathe in the pictures I saw. And the Libyan ran down the German boat and grabbed the migrants and hauled them out of the boat, put them on deck, and took them back to Libya. And they thought this was terrible because all these people wanted was a better life. Well, as Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, said, the way of life of Hungary is very fine, and the way of life of Germany is very fine, but everybody in the world is not free to enjoy it. And that's been the problem. They're increasing nationalism, increasing a rightward movement, despite what the press is saying. For example, in France, Marine Le Pen, the farther right party leader, got a third of the vote in the presidential election, even though she didn't win. In Holland, this Mark Rutte, the prime minister who had worked with Diederik Samson in organizing this wave of migrants, doing a deal with the Turks through Germany and this fellow Gerald Canales from Austria in his think tank, they were going to bring in 250,000 migrants a year from Turkey. And Geert Wilders from a farther right party, the Dutch Freedom Party, kept pushing Rutte to the right in the run-up to the general election. And while Rutte did win, he lost seats. And Wilders, the man who had been tried in court for speaking his mind about the migrants, he is now running the second largest party in the Dutch parliament as a result of the migrant wave.
So it's pushing countries to the right, and it's also creating great divisions in the countries politically.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, I think most people are in favor of helping their fellow man, but it's like if you have a homeless person in your own town and you try to help them, that's fine. But if you get 400 homeless people, then it overwhelms you and you can't help them, and it also brings your existence down.
It's exactly right.
Yeah, and that's the situation we're facing here, I guess. Mike, where else in history has weaponized migration been used?
Well, they tried to use it in Korea shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the communist parties in Eastern Europe, or what was once Eastern Europe, and Eastern Germany. And this would have been about late 90s, early 2000s. And there were a number of non-governmental organizations and religious leaders and a German named Follettson who had seen the fall of the wall and seen what had happened when people left one country and moved to another, and they thought they could apply this to Korea because although Korea had an illegitimate, terrible government that was harder than its own people, and they thought if enough people left Korea and moved to South Korea or to China, they could bring down the Korean government. Well, they failed in large part because the Chinese said, these people are economic migrants. We don't want them here, and they sent them back. and the South Koreans took a few, but then they realized they weren't philosopher kings. They saw that they were a kind of down-market migrants and refugees, and they said, look, we can't handle what we have. How can we take thousands more? So that failed. In Green Hill's book, she has about 64 instances where these issues failed or they succeeded, lines them out by country and by group and intent and purpose and so forth. So it's quite amazing that she went into such detail on this.
Now, Mike, we're almost out of time. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to share with the listeners?
What I would like to say is that the way you resolve this is not to keep up with Merkel's migrant attitude of y'all come. It's take the money that's being spent on NATO, on the military budgets of each of the members of NATO, and use it instead to help the migrants, to help them go home, to rebuild their countries, to educate them there. You can put up enough buildings in a hurry, prefab huts or whatever, much like they did during Second World War or afterwards, to house the migrants and displaced people, but maybe now with better technology, and get these people back, teach them something, teach them languages, teach them computer science, teach them how to fix a blown-up water plant. And this would be a lot better than letting this flood continue with not only the crisis between the migrants and the natives, but the clashes between those who want to welcome the migrants and those who say, we want our country back. We're not going to turn Germany into Turkey or to Syria or to Afghanistan. You know, we are the dominant people here, and we get to say what goes on. We're not going to have segregated swimming pool hours or segregated gym hours like some of these people want. The idea is to help them by helping them go home and rebuild their countries.
Right, and I think one of the biggest ways to do that is what you're saying is to stop the wars, to stop tearing
exactly.
apart these countries
yeah.
in Syria.
And the Europeans, of course, have the wrong idea. They've been sucked into the American Forever War with the Germans and the French and the British sending warplanes and ships to increase the bombing attacks on Syria and Iraq, for example.
Yeah, it really makes me sick. I just can't even think about it sometimes. It's so disturbing what we're doing. And I think so many Americans are clueless as to what's really going on there.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've talked to people here, even Germans, who think, oh, yes, America's doing the right thing. And I'm saying, well, to one girl I met in a bar, you realize that you go to the same university that Maria Ladenburger did, and she was raped and drowned by a migrant from Afghanistan. Don't you understand what's happening in your own university?
Right, and those things look orchestrated to create more tensions.
Yeah.
Well, Mike Springman, thank you so much for being on the show today, and I'm sure we'll have you on again in the near future. And thank you so much for writing this great book. I'm learning a lot by reading it, and I think between your first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, and this one, Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, people will have a really good sense of what's really going on in the world rather than what we're being fed through our propaganda on our mainstream TV stations.
That's right. And let me put in a plug. They can go to get these books on Amazon, and they can go to www.michaelspringmanwith2ms.com for the website for the books with reviews and background information on them.
Okay, great. And they could also buy them in their local bookstore, right?
They can order them through a local bookstore. They can get their library to order the books through one of the library services.
Now, that would be a great thing, to get it in the libraries. Great idea. Okay, Mike, well, thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity. I'm grateful that you gave me a chance to speak to your listeners.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with attorney, author, and former U.S. State Department diplomat J. Michael Springman discussing his latest book, which is called Goodbye Europe, Hello Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. His previous book, which I highly recommend, is called Visas for Al-Qaeda. And on a final note today, none of this would be happening if it weren't for 9/11, which was used to justify the endless global war on terror, which has led to the destruction of many countries and is responsible for the deaths of millions, and now also for this weaponized migration, and it's all still raging on with no end in sight. But the truth about 9/11 is the one thing that could put an end to the madness. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.